the advances in design cannot do the change itself. Like the players have to adapt and welcome the advances as well, because you can't. There's no cheating in disk design. You can never get anything without sacrificing something.
Welcome to Patent Pending, a show about the future of disc golf. I'm Jesse from Trash Panda, and on the show today, how a couple of friends in Denmark built a tool that could revolutionize the way we think about disc design. Just hear me out for a second. Why is it that some flight numbers don't seem accurate at all? And not to bring up a touchy subject, but why do two destroyers literally never fly the same? As disc golfers, these are the questions that keep us up at night, because the topic of disc design isn't talked about enough, and if you're anything like me, then you just want to know every little detail about how a disc is made. So I took a peek behind the curtain with one of the most innovative disc manufacturers in the game, and it all started exactly how you're thinking, while Niels, one of the founders of Loft Discs, was studying philosophy.
So I was playing a bit of Ultimate Frisbee and playing catch with some friends, and we had a great time making trick shot videos and stuff like that. And then at some point I was introduced to disc golf, and we played for an entire year with Ultimate Discs, and we kept claiming that the courses were rigged, the pars were impossible to reach, and yeah, we were obviously really good at it, but the courses were wrong. And then I got my first discs after probably a year, which was a Jawbreaker Magnet by Discraft and a Buzz OS, and I didn't know there was different versions of the Buzz, and all my friends had a Buzz, and I got the Buzz OS, so I yep. didn't use that for the first 2 years after I got the starter set.
It flies slightly different than an Ultimate disc.
Yeah, so, quite yeah, differently.
Opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, and then I got a Heat as a driver, and so I really used that one and my Magnet for most of the shots, mostly just the driver on anything. And I played a lot on some smaller courses in the beginning. And then I advanced to an 18-hole course, also here in the city. At that point, I was transitioning from studying philosophy to becoming a mechanical engineer. At the same time, I started becoming interested in disc design.
That's what I was going to ask, because philosophy to disc design seems like a very normal trajectory.
Yeah.
What stuck out to you? What piqued that initial interest for you with disc design?
When I was beginning to study as a mechanical engineer, that I began thinking in different ways in terms of a little bit about aerodynamics, and Asker, who I started Lyft with, was very interested in it as well. So we just theorized and talked about it a lot, as well as some other friends in our friend group. Yeah, so it was just something we were really interested in. And first off, it was obviously just figuring out the flight stats. What is that about? And try to really understand what those meant. And then slowly you get an idea of what it's all about. I think it stayed the same. I was very interested in it and was toying with some different ideas.
Like what? What were some of those initial ideas for you?
Asker and I talked about simulations, but not with the purpose of disc design, mm-hmm. just see if we could do it, simulate yeah. how a disc would fly. And it wasn't as much as the results, but just how would you do that? When you don't know much about the aerodynamics of a disc, it's very hard to come up with those things yourself. So yeah. you know there's something called drag, and you know there's something called lift, but it's not intuitive how that converts into how a disc actually flies. But it wasn't at a very high level until I was beginning my bachelor's degree. I did have one course where I was doing simulations of discs, but that was just some very basic simulations, and I couldn't really use the results for anything. It was just try to put it inside a simulator, which mm-hmm. it's called computational fluid dynamics. It didn't yield any usable results for anything.
Were you using just like a P2 or an AVR or something? Or
I think the Pure from Latitude was the first disc we okay. made a copy of. Like we took a picture from long away and zoomed in and made an outline and sketched in the drawing program. after that, I think we actually made a disc. We took a harp from Westside and we removed the entire flat plate and replaced it with glass fiber. So it became really stiff, but it was relevant for the course we were doing, but it was just making a super stiff disc with a super soft rim. So it would grab the ground.
Early gyro technology.
Yeah, exactly.
Did the glass fiber, I assume it was like glass fiber reinforced polypropylene or something.
Exactly.
Like that. Did it
no, it's, yeah, it's epoxy resin.
Oh, okay.
Infused with glass fiber.
Did it crack, or was the harp rim enough to withstand the
I still have it. The rim still it protects the glass fiber part really well, but it's obviously modified, so it's not legal, and it's also way too stiff. But it's efficient in the regard that you can have a very thin flat plate, and it's not very heavy, so you could get a very significant gyro effect out of it if you were to succeed with it somehow.
So you're studying mechanical engineering and start to mess around with stuff. You and Asker are having fun. And what happens next?
So what really happened was that I was doing a bachelor's thesis or my final project as a mechanical engineer. And this was where I was visiting Castoplast and working together with Castoplast to look at the deformations and defects in production, how that would affect the flight of discs. This was also when we started working on the actual flight path simulator with the intent to look how would one defect affect the flight path of a disc.
This is a disc coming out of a machine with a small dimple or a small defect in the manufacturing process, or are you talking about after the disc is being used?
I'm talking about coming out of the machine being puddle top or super domey, or
yep.
We were trying to examine as many production defects we could possibly find.
Because up to this point, people are theorizing that, hey, I think my domey disc actually glides more. I think my puddle top, you know, actually goes to the ground pretty quick. But you're actually trying to see if that's true.
That was the exact thought behind the project. So I was doing this project with another friend. Yeah, it's not one of the guys from Lyft, but he's also a decent disc golfer as well. Yeah, so we worked on this project and we kind of got the flight path simulator to work in the end and barely got some results that showed what we anticipated. It was very slow and inefficient, and at that point that was as far as we got, but we knew that it was possible to simulate discs at this point. And so 3 months after we finished the project, Asker, who actually helped me in the last days finish the simulations, he had actually been talking for a long time about designing discs, but he then asked me, Nils, couldn't you use that simulator for designing discs? I was like, yeah, I guess you could. And he's much of an entrepreneur and I'm not. And starting a company was not something I would ever consider on my own. He kept asking, and he had the concept for hydrogen already back then. He was putting with P2s actually, and he still liked the P2 for that matter. But but he was saying it's stupid that we have to aim right off the basket when we're putting instead of putting at the directly at the basket. And I was like, yeah, good point. And at that point, I was putting with Pures myself, which is very, very low profile compared to the hydrogen. So the idea was pretty strange for me to make a deep, slow putter. Once we made it, I've really liked the transition. And I guess you know the feeling of making your own discs. You can't not love them. It's,
We're 100% biased. When you finally made the hydrogen, have you also finalized the flight simulator, or and is loft a thing at this point, or when did those things happen?
We started working on the simulator in August, and this is also where we started the company.
What year is this?
2020.
Okay.
In the following months, we were first working on the simulator as well as the design, and trying to find manufacturers, making a lot of groundwork. When we found a place, and we also ordered some prototypes. And from then on, we started working harder and harder, and Asker had a full-time job as well, so he was really working a lot at that point. we ended up getting the simulator to work much better than we did earlier. Since then, we've optimized it further, so we can now do a full disk simulation within probably 10 to 12 hours, whereas it would probably take 2 to 3 days at that point.
And just to explain to the public real quick, you're talking about a simulator where you can plug in the dimensions of any disk with 3D design.
Yeah.
And you can see how it would fly. Literally anything. So you could design something brand new that's not even on the market right now, and it would simulate how that would fly.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And you get that flight path in three dimensions, so you can see how high will it fly, how far will it drift to the sides and everything. It has been a really cool tool to play around with, but also to make these designs with. And also just saving time in prototypes. If just the fact that you can compare your designs to other designs beforehand. Obviously, once you have your finished design, you still have to produce it, and it will deviate a little bit from what you were drawing.
Yeah.
And then you can redraw the actual disk that comes out of it and see how it compares to what you intended.
So just to help me take a step back and compare this to other manufacturers. If you're utilizing a simulation software that you've designed and created, how are other manufacturers designing disks? Are they prototyping through 3D printing, or are they just, is there enough knowledge there that they can say, we think it's going to fly like this, let's make it? Are they guessing? What's happening with everyone else?
So I know we are not the first to use computational fluid dynamics. I know others have tried that, and also wind tunnels has been used. I think the reason it's not mentioned a whole lot is because these results you get from the wind tunnels or the computational fluid simulations, they aren't that useful in themselves. You kind of have to have something like a flight path to visualize what these differences actually mean.
It sounds like disk design by and large is trial and error.
Yeah.
It's really learning, like building the plane in the air, for lack of a better analogy.
Yeah.
Building the disk in the air is probably a better analogy that I should have gone with, but okay. So you build out the simulator. You've got the, Asker has the idea for the hydrogen, you want something that flies pretty straight. When did we decide, okay, let's build a company out of this, let's make Loft happen? What was that process like?
At that very point where we started working hard on the simulator to get it to work, at that point we knew we would start a company. And that's also when we started looking for a third guy, because we, Asker and I can do a lot of things, but we can't do everything. So we found we talked to our friend Casper. So at this point, we were doing it all at once, trying to find out how to start a company, finding the third guy, starting with the working on this simulator and designing the first disk, getting the first prototypes and looking for manufacturers. I think around the time when we found the manufacturer, we also found out that we wanted to do a Kickstarter campaign, both because of the price of a mold.
Absolutely.
It would empty our entire savings to buy the mold and the plastic and everything before starting selling. So we thought that would be a good idea, and it turned out it was. We just tried to explain everything we did in the design of hydrogen in that Kickstarter campaign. There was a lot of momentum from home, from here from Denmark in the beginning, because we were the first Danish company to start making discs. And yeah, when the Kickstarter was running, it was just spreading like wildfire.
It blew up. Yeah.
It was pretty wild. So we put all the thoughts and all the details about the simulator and everything onto that Kickstarter campaign. And I think people liked the transparency. We tried to keep everything honest and show how excited we were for our own concepts and designs.
For sure.
Yeah.
I think to a lot of people, the hydrogen release seemed like, you know, a new company starting up a project, but really it was years in the making, and it was built out of your pain points too, right? Like want a putter that goes straight at the basket, not something that goes, you have to throw it to the right just to get it to go to the place you want it to go. So yeah. I think it really landed and connected with people. And that's obvious by the way, just how much traction it had and how much success you had through that. I'm curious, I think for anyone who's held the hydrogen or held the borium, both of those feel different to some extent than your, I'll call it your average putter on the market, your average distance driver, right? They've got some design elements that are slightly different. Was there intention behind that early on, like wanting to do something different and fill almost a gap in the market? Or was it based just strictly on what you liked?
Well, there was a very obvious gap in the market as we saw it in Speed One discs. Hmm. So there's a lot of old discs like the Super Puppy and a lot of the discs you would use 30, 40 years ago that would have been to some extent similar to the hydrogen, but much deeper and more frisbee-like. Aside from that, we didn't feel like there were any modern design that would utilize what a slow disc can. We felt like it's not only about making a disc that goes directly at a basket when you're putting, but also when you're throwing, it just holds. It was supposed to hold the angle, and I really feel we succeeded with that, making a disc that does that. And what we can't say much about, we don't have a whole lot of sponsored pros, especially not at that point. So we can't say exactly what you should use it for, but we can tell you that this stuff does something that no other disc does. Like, we wanted to engage people in exploring the designs with us. So yes, we wanted to make something new, but we, it's not like we felt these have to feel differently, but we knew they had to feel differently in order to make them fly differently.
When we come back, Niels and I take a deep dive into disc design, and he attempts to explain why two destroyers never fly the same. Have you ever wondered how Jomez Pro is able to employ 20 full-time crew members, produce tournament coverage, create off-season series like The Putting Game, and develop podcasts like this one? Well, it's because of one amazing group of diehard disc golf fans, the Jomez Pro Patreon community. The financial support Jomez Pro receives from Patreon is essential to their mission of pushing disc golf to new places. It's also a great place to influence what happens behind the scenes. They often post videos before the public to get everyone's feedback, and it's just a great place to discuss topics like your favorite touring pros and cool merch ideas. So if that sounds like something you'd like to be a part of, consider joining. They have three tiers to fit your budget, and on top of all of that, they post exclusive content that doesn't get published on the YouTube channel, monthly giveaways like signed discs and practice baskets, big discounts to their shop, and you can even get your name listed on the coverage by signing up for the Founders Club. You can visit jomezpro.com/Patreon and sign up today to get instant access to all of the Patreon benefits. Honestly, aside from just watching, or listening in this case, signing up for the Jomez Pro Patreon is easily the most impactful way to support Jomez Pro and their mission. So sign up today at jomezpro.com/Patreon, and if you're already one of the 3,000 plus members, thank you. Welcome back to the show. As many of you may know, disc golf started in the 1970s with frisbee-style discs like the Space Saucer and the Pluto Platter. Then, in 1983, Dave Dunipace changed the game with the first beveled edge disc and ushered in a new era of disc golf. Since then, innovations were relatively steady for some time. From discs with dimples like golf balls, to the wider acceptance of gyro technology, to a disc that literally had no distinct top or bottom, innovation within disc design has been pretty consistent over the last 40 years. So as Niels and I began our deep dive into disc design, I had to ask what he thought disc design would look like tomorrow.
I think it's hard to tell. I think it's a very, very good question, and I think it's very exciting. I'm so excited to now be a part of the future of disc design, because when you look back in the beginning or in the middle of the zeros, like from 2002 maybe to 2010 or something like that, people started making a lot of innovations. There was the Quest Applied Technologies. Yeah, yeah, and also a Diskwing who made a rounded rim disk like Borium. They tried something new a lot with dimbles and weird domes and stuff like that.
Yeah, the 10-meter brick and the wheel.
Yeah.
And they had some interesting stuff that came out.
Yeah. So I think during that period of time, a lot of stuff have been tried out. And I think we will mostly see small advances from now on. But I'm excited to see if something will drastically change at some point. The advances in design cannot do the change itself. Like, the players have to adapt and welcome the advances as well, because you can't.
Yeah.
There's no cheating in disc design. You can never get anything without sacrificing something. It's
interesting.
So, yeah, you cannot make a faster disc without making it turn more and fade more. It gets more unstable the faster it is, and stuff like that. It's
so you always gain something from this disc, but if you whatever you gain, you're losing something as well.
Yeah,
we're talking about disc design. We're talking about advances within disc design. But ultimately, we have to acknowledge that there are PDGA technical standards that are pretty much a box which all disc designs have to fit within, right? Whether it's flexibility or certain size restraints, different types of things, weight, etc. Do you find that those, and they're online for people if people want to look them up to see what those standards actually are, but do you find for innovation in the sport that maybe those technical standards are prohibiting innovation? Are they welcoming innovation within that box? Do you think there's room where we might need to break out of those? What's your feel and gauge and just in general towards the PDGA technical standards?
So I think they are limiting the possibilities, and I think they should be. Otherwise, like an arrow bee would be like, which is has a big hole in it. It's maybe a 30-centimeter big ring that flies extremely far. I think it's called the farthest flying object. Thrown by
hand. It went like 300 feet farther than David Wiggins' boss.
Yeah.
For the world record disc. Yeah. So, yeah, it went far.
Yeah. So there's no doubt at all that you could make advances without the PDGA standards. There's a reason that they are as the way they are. So you would get a completely different set of objects if you were to ease on those rules. But it's definitely the PDGA standards is also the reason why advancements at this point are pretty small, and you don't make big steps at a time because there's only a certain amount of things you can do to disc design within the standards.
What about 3D printing in disc golf? I know 3D printing to some extent is used in disc golf for the prototyping process. And I believe, you know, I know there's one company, maybe even a couple, that are doing some 3D printed PDGA approved discs now.
Yeah.
What do you think about that technology? Do you think there's much future there? Are we there yet? Is it coming? What do you think about 3D printing in disc golf?
I think it's hard to scale, but I think at some point it will probably pick up. I think there's a lot of potential. We actually just transitioned from we used to make our prototypes from a block of TPU that was CNC milled into the shape of the disc, but we just switched over to a 3D printing method in TPU. But it's just very expensive and time consuming and inefficient overall, and there's a lot of waste as well. So I wouldn't say there doesn't have to be a lot of waste in TPU manufacture or in a 3D printed TPU, but there's a lot of downsides at the moment. But I think it would be viable, as the prototypes we're getting right now are very, very nice and very accurate to what we are drawing.
When it comes to the composition of discs and buying two of the same disc, a lot of people seem to have the problem of inconsistency, that two destroyers don't fly the same. Two of this disc don't fly the same. Can you, as someone who just understands this on a level that most of us never will. Can you explain to us, me and everyone else, why discs don't fly consistently or the same, even though they're the same plastic and the same mold and even the same run?
No, but I can try. it's such a difficult question, because, you know, I'm specialized in like thermodynamics and fluid mechanics, so mm-hmm. I'm not that much of a plastic guy as an engineer. And something happens when you mold a disc. Sometimes the cooling is different, sometimes some production parameters change, sometimes the plastic, mm-hmm. the batch of plastic is different. There's a ton of things that can deviate and can cause variations. But I can say this much, in general, the faster the disc, the bigger deviations or the bigger differences mm-hmm. you'll see in flight of a disc. And these differences are often caused by the disc either getting more domey or more flat or even puddle top. This will affect what's called the parting line of the disc, which is the point where the more or less the air is split. It's the point at the disc, the line around all the way around the disc where the mold is split into two.
Yeah.
So this the height of this parting line will often deviate when some of the production parameters aren't as they usually are. And this will affect the flight. So to that extent, I can explain what happens. But sometimes you get a domey disc where the parting line moves up, and sometimes you get a domey disc where the parting line is lower than usual. Sometimes you have a super flat disc where the parting line is incredibly high, and sometimes you have a flat disc where the parting line is really low. And I know we are very new to manufacturing discs compared to many of the other manufacturers out there. We can obviously see if we adjust this production parameter, it will mm-hmm. make this happen. So we know some things about what we can change. Then you can use a different kind of plastic and it will act completely opposite. And it's just very, very hard to predict everything. So this is something that's trial and error, and those that have done it for a long time are very good at it, and those that haven't done it for a long time aren't always as good at it.
And even maybe those who have done it for a long time are sometimes not as good at it. So it varies. It seems very complex.
Yeah. So it's something you can utilize, and it's also something that is very annoying as a manufacturer. But yeah.
As far as flight numbers, I know Innova was the one, like everyone's pretty much adapted the Innova model of speed, glide, turn, fade, and everyone has their own versions. There's no set standard. And at the end of the day, like one manufacturer's 10 speed might not be the same as someone else's 10 speed. Do you think we need to standardize and find some way to almost homogenize flight numbers? And is that something that a simulation software could do, or what are your thoughts about flight numbers?
So overall, I think the flight numbers are really, really cool. I know that when I started playing disc golf, it was one of the things that got me excited, because it's something that's a little mysterious in the beginning and you have to find out what it is. And once you do, it's very inspirational in many ways. So at one point I was thinking, okay, maybe I should go with a 4-glide driver instead of a 5-glide to make it drift less towards the sides. And so you can like come up with all sorts of ideas to your game based on these numbers. But at the end of the day, a domier disc will have a higher lift force and be more glidey. And even though the stats are the same for a domier disc as that they are on a flat disc, you can only put one number on the disc.
Yeah.
So it's, you could say it's the fact that these numbers are supposed to represent how the disc flies but at the same time, you have production variations. There are some issues to it. Yeah. But I know a lot of pro players, they don't look at these numbers. They know the molds, and then they try to find the versions or the runs that fits their game the best.
Yeah.
We're working on a series of videos where we try our best to describe our interpretation of the flight ratings in scientific terms, but in a way that most people can understand it as well.
Can still understand.
Yeah.
Well, so far you've been describing things in a way that I understand, so I think most people will be able to understand it just fine.
I hope so. Thank you.
Is there anything that really excites you about disk design, or anything, you know, just you want to say to the people who aren't necessarily thinking about disk design, just in general, what's exciting, what's next, what's the future of disk design hold that gets you out of bed in the morning?
Well, I probably have to throw in a small spoiler then, because one of the things we're working on is a quite significantly different disk, because okay. It's larger in diameter.
Ooh.
Yeah. But I won't say much more than that. Yeah, I'm really excited for it, especially because at this point we don't know a whole lot of about the use, and while we have the simulations ready, we haven't explored fully what possibilities lies within larger diameters. But we think there might be some really cool disk designs to be made. So, and then after that, maybe bag designs. Because
yeah, there we
when
go.
You make bigger disks, you also need bigger bags.
Bigger bags.
Yeah, nothing is certain, and we have to verify results and make sure that it's a good idea before we make it.
That's Niels Vestergaard Sorensen, one of the founders of Loft Discs. As of this recording, they have 3 discs on the market and follow a pretty unique naming convention. One that's based on the periodic table, which is both more interesting and more confusing than you might expect. What about the periodic table? When did that come into play?
I think we're just brainstorming ideas for names, because you can either go the route of you want something with a name that says something about how the disc flies, or do we want something mm-hmm. that's more maybe graphical, like animal names or stuff like that. But it's just really, really hard to come up with original ideas. But we figured that the periodic table was a good way for us to put out the image that, like, our entire process behind designing the discs, we try to be scientific in our approach to the disc design. And we figured that the names of the periodic table sounded good, and it worked pretty well for us. And on top of that, we found this system that if you know the periodic table very well, you can also kind of predict how a disc will fly based on its name. So you know that if it's a high atomic number, it would be a faster disk. And if it's in the right side of the periodic table, it's overstable, and the left side it's understable. So
wow, I'd have to imagine there are some communication issues with those names on the back end. Do you find that when you say borium or silicon that certain people in the manufacturing process or the tool making process or anything expect or are misunderstanding what you mean by it?
Yes. And I think this one should have stayed secret, but our first mold of hydrogen was made in aluminum, but our silicon mid-range, we first thought it was, we wanted to call it aluminum. And then we changed the design a little bit, changed it to silicon. When we first got the mold, it had the name aluminum on it, and it was a steel mold. So it was so confusing for everybody.
Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. Patent Pending is presented by Jomez Pro, and you can subscribe anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you want to follow us on Instagram, we are at Patent Pending Show. And if you want to contact the team, our email address is patentpendingshow@jomezpro.com. This episode was produced by Andy Padula, with music composed by Starframe. I'm Jesse from Trash Panda, and you've been listening to Patent Pending.